You and I have discussed this Patriot mythology quite extensively, I think, Gary. And I have been nothing less than, I guess, blown away by what we've discovered. So, why should Patriots be concerned about accepting this Patriot mythology?
Well, it's misinformation, disinformation, and distraction. If you don't have a solid and a common foundation, how can you proceed with an objective in mind? It's destructive. And as we proceed with this, I think people will begin to understand how destructive potentially it is if they can overcome the conditioning that they've been through, and we'll get into that conditioning shortly.
Well, I mean, is there really any difference anymore between news and entertainment?
Well, I was raised with people like Walter Cronkite. Harry Reasoner was a latecomer. That was news. I mean, they would sit down for a half an hour and cover 8, 10 stories briefly, but they would be concise in the details. They had the who, what, why, where, when, the information available. And now when I watch the news, I can't say I watch the news. They call it what I watch when I watch what they call the news, which I do, breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. Just to see what I might be able to catch that's happening, then I can come out the internet and kind of find out what really is happening. But this morning, for example, let's see, we got a football player on CNN, we had a football player that murdered somebody, and on Fox, we had this guy, Suge something, a rapper, who I guess he killed somebody too. Now, is that news or is that entertainment? So it's kind of really juxtaposed with the alternate media, and we rely more on the alternate media or other online sources for real news. However, when we get to the online media and the other news sources on the internet, we still get a lot of entertainment. The entertainment on the other one deals with the type of stories I just mentioned, but in the alternate media, a lot of time we get fiction presented as news. And that is patriot mythology. It's got a foundation, it's got a history, and a lot of those histories go back to the early 80s when I first started getting involved in the patriot community. Actually, as far back in 78, I think, when I got on Prodigy, there was a lot of, not a lot, there were patriot mythologies about things. One of the big items then was income tax. So everybody had a theory about income tax. But then, as time went on and the movement expanded and the objectives in the Patriot movement expanded, especially 93, Waco, militia, and all this, then there's a proliferation of Patriot mythology, and a lot of it was debunked back in the fax days, or the pre-fax days, maybe even before I got involved. But a lot of it was debunked. A lot of the people that I knew were serious researchers, and they would tell me, this is bogus. And I'd look into it, I'd look at their research, I'd go do my own, and find out it was bogus. And but I got an introduction, what, 30 years ago, that there's a lot of this stuff going on. But some of the same stories, then, that were debunked have come back in their third or fourth iteration because somebody reads something and they believe it to be true, and then, well, quite often they try and get somebody else to experiment with it. Others have been debunked to the point of they're still being propagated. The one I'm thinking of in particular came up recently at the Bundy Ranch that somebody was trying to get Cliven Bundy and Ryan Payne to sign liens against the judge for $3 million. I showed, well, Ryan, Cliven's attorney said, "Hey, stay away from that shit." But Ryan Payne was still thinking about it. That'd be nice to get $3 million. So I had to find a court case, and it had to do with something that I was involved in '97, which was the Florida common law court trial. But Philip Marsh, the Pilot Connection, had filed liens because he had picked up something that had been debunked by other people, and he filed liens. And in the appellate court decision, they said the act of filing the lien is criminal in itself. But the liens are back. And even though he spent prison time because he filed those liens, people are trying to get other people to file their liens. They won't do it themselves, but they'll try and get somebody else to do it. I don't want to mention any names here, so I won't, but the lien one is, it is a crime to file the lien in the public records. So, but entertainment, that's entertainment. It's becoming entertainment. It's not news. The news is it doesn't work. The entertainment is, try this, it'll work. It's a fantasy, it's a fiction. So,
well, then in that
case, I guess
case,
we can't get news unless we dig for it.
Well, then in that case, what's the difference between real conspiracies and mythology?
Well, what are real conspiracies, and are they as extensive as they're presented? Let's go back to 1941. Pearl Harbor, was there reason to believe the Japanese were pissed off at us? Yes, we had done things, if you do the research, we have done things to piss them off. We used to give them oil that they refined into gasoline. We gave them high-quality steel. There were ships going with hundreds of tons of this stuff across the ocean all the time. But as they went into Manchuria and things heated up in Europe, we started cutting back. And we knew at the time that eventually it would piss them off because they had no resource for that and they would have to go out and seek the resources, which eventually they did, but they were so pissed off, and there was good reason, good reason to think that, hey, they're going to retaliate against us because they relied on us when they went to war, and now we're cutting back the resources they need to continue the wars in Manchuria and other places. And they did, so they started invading the in the South Pacific to get the oil resources, and Southeast Asia to get the mineral, the tin, and the iron resources. And, we eventually would have gone to Australia, which has quite a bit of resources, but their retaliation against us could have been anticipated. Some people want to make it a conspiracy very extensively. No, it wasn't. It was to some degree because the government kept quiet about it. Why they keep quiet about it is Winston Churchill had been trying to get Roosevelt to get involved in Europe because the British would have lost if they had to fight that battle alone. They were in Africa, North Africa. They were in Italy. They'd been kicked out of France. Well, they were kicked out of Italy, too. And they were concerned. The Battle of Britain, all the aircraft, air superiority on the part of the Germans, was devastating to England, and they were getting back further and further in a corner, and they were intent on us getting involved in the war. And Roosevelt agreed with them, but the sympathy of America, especially with a large German heritage population and Japanese population and Italian population, was reluctant to go to war. So there probably was a conspiracy to conceal certain things that made it conducive to expecting a reaction. So on April or December 7th, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. The next day, the United States Congress, at the request of the president, declared on war on Japan. On December 15th, Hitler declared war on the United States, and I think it was the same day that the United States declared war on Germany and Italy. So, but there was a degree of conspiracy behind this, as political maneuvering is more appropriate. Was there some in September 11th, 2001, with the planes flying into the World Trade Center buildings and the Pentagon? I think the same thing, that the government was remiss or wanted an attack to justify a retaliatory action, and it's very possible. Did they set it up? No. But everybody wants to think black and white. If there's a little conspiracy, it's a whole conspiracy. There's nothing in between. Like World War II, were we trying to provoke them to do something, perhaps not knowing what it was, but trying to provoke an action that would justify a reaction on our part? So, is it a conspiracy, or is it a conspiracy, or conspiracy? Patriot mythology abounds with conspiracies. Almost any time somebody dies, it's a conspiracy. Who was the guy that Gray State movie. It was the guy, I don't recall the guy's name. He and his wife, it was murder, initially declared a murder suicide. I haven't seen anything to change that, but some of the people jumped up right away and they said, oh, he's killed because of Gray State. Well, no, Gray State's with the editors now. I mean, there's an unedited version on the internet for free, so it's out. They didn't stop the film. If it was a conspiracy, they would have gone at what they had to destroy everything. But people want every death to have somebody to blame.
Oh, David Crowley, that's who you mean.
Crowley, yes. So conspiracies are one thing, mythologies are another. They're interrelated. The mythologies come to creating, I don't want to say a solution, but a story around an alleged conspiracy, whether that conspiracy is the Philadelphia conspiracy, the corporate United States conspiracy, to a high degree, the Federal Reserve conspiracy, that everything we can lay fault there. So we look for solutions. Mythology now creates solutions as a consequence of the absolute acceptance of an absolute complete conspiracy. And so there's a close relationship between the two. One fuels the other.
Well, I think something too that I kept noticing, with the previous things that you and I have discussed regarding patriot mythology is that not everything the government is involved in is a conspiracy. The reason why this mythology is dangerous is because it tends to create a conspiracy where none exists.
Well, yes, and then that conspiracy will tend to fuel the mythology about its background, its sources, and everything else. For example, I don't recall back in the 70s and 80s ever hearing of what's referred to now as the Philadelphia conspiracy. That's kind of a new innovation, and somebody just had to lay blame on the wrong court, I guess is the best way to put it. But then that eventually, in showing the evil of government, that it led to another rather interesting one, which is the corporate United States, based on the Act of Congress in 1781 that created a corporation that is defined in the Act as 10 miles square and creates a city government out of what was a federal responsibility under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. Reserving that 10 mile square as the seat of government and giving exclusive legislative jurisdiction to the United States government. And it was a mud, it was mud, it was a swamp, it was unkept, it was probably the nastiest capital in the world. And in 17, this is a consequence of research, shame that to blow away mythologies this way, but in 1770, 8 or 79, this guy, don't recall his name right now, came to work, hired by Congress to look. He was an engineer looking at trying to make a better city out of D.C. And finally, he said, "We need an independent government. I can't go to you guys and let you bicker for months over whether I can get some money to do something or anything." So they created in 1781 the Act of 1781, creating a public corporation over Washington, D.C., like every other city in the country had, the co corporate nature. And by 1783, Washington had become a showcase. The streets were high and dry even after a rain. They'd addressed the drainage, they kept it clean, they put in sidewalks or boardwalks, they cleaned up the city. And now, all of a sudden, within just a few short years, it went from swamp to something else. So people use that act to say corporate United States, but wait, Philadelphia conspiracy. If the conspiracy started in 1787, why would they need a another conspiracy in 1871 to try and create the same all-powerful government with no regard to the people in 80 years later?
Right, and I think what you're describing here really is just a municipality, just like every other, town and city across the nation, more or less.
It was, and let's go back to the conspiracy of 1787, the Philadelphia conspiracy. We talked about that at length in one of the BELs, but they were trying to do something that had never been done in the history of the world before, or at least I've not been able to find anybody that did a number of things to put the control of government completely and the creation of government completely in the hands of the people. Nowhere else on earth, maybe in a tribe somewhere, but as far as a government over a large society, never in the history of the world was the power ever from the people. It all came from God and filtered down through the current monarch. He could pass it on, all kinds of things. He could have it taken away by another one that had royal blood. But if you didn't have royal blood, you were out of the picture. Cromwell found that out. They would never accept him as a king, so he was the protector of the realm. But they created a government that's foundation, that's right to exist, came from the people. And in doing so, there was an English Constitution. People argue this point, but there are books on the English Constitution. But it was piecemeal. It began with the Magna Carta, and things would happen. Some things would change over years, and there was kind of a ledger kept of what became the rights of the English people. And the rights kept improving. Occasionally, they set back some. But they kept improving. So there was an English Constitution, but it was cumbersome because it was based on court decisions and this and that and other things. So it was not in one place. And you had to be a student and study for years to really understand this thing because of the change in the language over that period of time. So we did what was unheard of before then, too, and put on paper the grant of authority, the grant of the powers and the limitations on the government in a single piece of paper. And then we added a second piece of paper called the Bill of Rights a few years later. So we had created something that never existed before. Now, that was a conspiracy to recreate a monarchy and vest the power in one person or an elite, an oligarchy. No, it was surprisingly, if you think about it, it took power away from those that made it, because we were so used to aristocracy or wealthy people being in control that those people went to that convention were aristocracy. They were wealthy. Alexander Hamilton wasn't even invited. Sam Adams was one of the few exceptions that participated extensively in the creation of government, but not in the Constitutional Convention, because he was a poor man. So this aristocracy, this American aristocracy, comes together and writes a government on paper that takes away their authority as the aristocracy. Now anybody can be elected into a position of authority within the government. So the government was created by that Constitution, unique to the world, and still unique, believe it or not, still unique, because the constitutions in other countries now are not given by the will of the people. They just say that. So we've got these two conspiracies that actually contradict each other. But people don't see that because everything's black and white. Everything government is evil, or everything government is good. And if everything government is good, you must be a government agent. And if everything is evil, you're a good patriot that can't figure out there's a contradiction between these elements.
Well, remember too, also, I mean, these mythologists can become so ridiculous to the point that they refuse to even calculate the amount of feces generated by an army in the desert, which, of course, is what you kind of pointed out once before too.
Well, yeah, and this one goes back to the 90s too, and maybe into the 80s. Back then, it was Russian troops. There were 6 million Russian troops across the Mexican border just waiting to invade the United States. More recently, when it came back, it first came back as the Russians, then somebody got smart. Nobody's going to believe the Russians are doing it, man. They broke up the Soviet Union. Let's make them Chinese. Yeah, well, problem with that, putting 6 million people in one place. Let's look at it a different way. 180 tons of food had to be brought into West Berlin during the airlift, or of goods. 180 tons of goods had to be brought in every day in the airlift to West Berlin. And I'm not sure the population. I think it was 7 or 8 million people, including the military forces. 180 tons a day. Now, that doesn't count the waste from these people. And the demand for water, well, they had rivers there, but out in the desert in Mexico, you don't have rivers. So the water's got to be hauled in, or you've got to have a very deep well. But 180 tons, let's be realistic. Let's say only 100 tons. 2 million pounds of food have to be and products have to be brought in to sustain the 6 million people. Where do they shit? Man, there's 5 or 6 acre feet of shit every day. You know, what are they got, a big septic tank? They just happen to have a high volume waste processing plant there already in the middle of the desert. But see, common sense sometimes defies the whole concept presented under patriot mythology, but people don't want to see it. There's a black, back to the black and white. Oh yes, that's going to happen, and the United States is doing nothing about it. Now I guess we gave up with the Chinese, and now we've got 6 million immigrants across the border, and we've welcomed them in. And then once they get here, they can go buy the guns. They didn't have to bring the guns with them. But these are the kinds of things, the absurdities, and there was never a reality to them, as time has proven, except the last one. We do have a lot of immigrants coming in, and most of a lot of them aren't Mexicans. I don't know what the motivation is to want to believe these things, but common sense quite often dictates the, I don't want to say idiocy, but the absurdity of some of the mythologies.
Well, what are the effects of spreading patriot mythology, though?
Well, let's see. If I was the government and I saw all these people saying, we got to do something about the government, what would be the most important thing I can think of? Now, people talk about Sun Tzu, and I get a kick out of that, because Sun Tzu lived in a world where armies marched on their feet. Maybe a few important people rode on horses, but it was a different kind of war than would be fought today, because we've got aircraft, missiles, tanks, and all these other things. But the effect of divide and conquer, which he spoke about, and making your enemy believe you got something when you don't have something, or that you don't have something when you do have something, are concepts that are embodied in Sun Tzu's Art of War. And they're realistic. So if the government can propagate a division by having us fighting about whether planes or rockets flew into the World Trade Center and or Pentagon, whether there are Russian troops or Chinese troops across the Mexican border, any one of these mythologies, corporate United States, or, you know, realistically, the government has usurped authority. They have gone beyond the Constitution, and they're violating it. That's clean and simple. It doesn't need an excuse. It doesn't need a monster to support it. But if we're fighting about what's true here, I'll give you a good example. Today in a discussion on Facebook, somebody brought up something, and I mentioned the absurdity of it, and I was accused of being a Fed. Creates division.
Again? Oh, God.
Oh, I'm used to it. But that division, who does that serve? Does that serve us to argue about shit that doesn't matter? What matters is restoration of constitutional government, but we're squandering our time. We're wasting our energy and effort and everything chasing ghosts, when in fact the objective, restoration of constitutional government, is put by the wayside. It's gone. You know, I use a number of different signatures on my emails, and probably the one that best fits this: so long as we fight amongst ourselves, we will never have to face the more dangerous task of fighting against our enemy. You know, I coined that because of what we see, the division. And one of my first articles on the blog back in 2009 was the divide and conquer article. So, you know, the problem is we're creating our own problem. And who would benefit from this? So let's go back a little further. And I think I addressed this before, but it's probably worth mentioning again. When I was looking into the alleged drone strike, I hate that word alleged, but in this case we have to use it, the alleged drone strike at the Bundy Ranch, I tracked down Mr. X and I spoke with him. And he told me in detail, and he was so fluid with it that I don't think anything he said was wrong. He was fed for some information that was purported to be an active duty military officer that he'd work with in doing the research that he gets paid to do, which is online research, open source research on the internet, over certain subjects. And I guess he gets paid piecework or something. I'm not sure how he gets paid for it, but he works with this guy. So the guy fed him this drone strike information. Holder directed DOD to send drones to the Bundy Ranch, observe, and perhaps fire, take everybody out. I went on the internet then and looked at, or in Facebook, and kind of looked at the stories that this guy would post, initial, original post, not shared, but original post quite often. And they were, I guess, sharing because he went to an article and he would bring it and post it, the URL, so it was originally from him. Probably other people did too. I don't want to say he's the only one that put it in there, but he brought it into the realm of Facebook, and then people start sharing it. So it propagates itself. It grows like a weed sometimes. So this guy liked theories, and so he liked putting them out. So if the government can find somebody that will bring this stuff into the current realm, into the, and Facebook is a major source of communication within the Patriot community. If he can introduce it there and get it shared, and they introduce it elsewhere and it gets shared, it propagates. It grows like a weed, and everybody's seeing it. And we'll get into the volume shortly. But does it have truth to it? Well, this guy, look at it this way. This guy was used as a funnel to get the drone strike into the Patriot community. He was the single source of that information coming through the vortex from government into the Patriot side. He was used, I think.
Oh, wow.
So, but then it propagated. And look what happened with the drone strike, with the Oath Keepers who had taken an oath to protect and defend and had gone to the Bundy Ranch with a mission of protecting the Bundys, decided that they would rather protect themselves. And so they left.
Yeah, I
So,
remember that.
interestingly, it served a rather interesting, useful purpose in creating a perspective of Oath Keepers that had not been presented by them, but became apparent by the actual circumstances on the ground. But this is how they come in, and they prolific. Most of the ones I see, unless they're a current news story that, somebody so and so died, so the government's behind it. But when we get into the more extensive ones that seem to have a background, a historical background, those are ones that have been around for a long time. The government dusts them off, changes it from Russians to Chinese, throws it out there, and people eat it up. So, the division comes as a result of, and is a desirable, according to Sun Tzu, is a desirable means of creating division in fighting. I think you often use the term balkanization. I'm not sure what it means. It sounds like a Russian term or something, but I think I know what you mean. It is creating division and strife within our own community. And if you're not organized, how can you get organized to do something effective?
Course. So I think what you're kind of pointing out is really a lot of just squandered time and effort then, as well as the fact that because these mythologies are not true, it's very, I guess it would be divisive under false pretenses.
Well, let's put it this way. As far as squandered time and effort, with people I know, I'm willing to spend time explaining things to them. That's what these BELs are all about, isn't it? So, how many hours? We've got hundreds of hours in this. But if I can do it once here, spend a couple hours here, a couple hours of preparation, and then a couple hours doing a show here, then it might get out to a bunch of people. I wish it had the ability to grow like a vicious rumor, but at least we're doing something about it. But a lot of people get caught in the trap of every time they see it posted on Facebook, they'll go in and challenge it. If they don't agree with it, they'll go in and challenge it. So, we're lucky. That's 4 hours of your time, 4 hours of my time for something that's permanent and hopefully concise and instructional and educational in regards to the subject matter. But if you think of how many people on the internet in a single battle with one person, A said this, and I'm going to go after A, he might spend 4 or 8 or 10 hours getting in a pissing contest with B. And then C takes B's side. Now he's got to go spend 4, 6, 8 hours, maybe he can copy and paste some of his old stuff, and argue with C. But C's then arguing with F, who's on the side of A. Campbell's alphabet soup. It gets confusing as hell. So
I've seen some of that.
how much time is squandered, and how much energy that could be productively put to reinstituting, restoring constitutional government in this country that goes here? Let's say you had to dig a ditch, and some guys thought round nose shovels, and some guys thought square nose shovels were the way to do it. And they start arguing about it instead of digging the ditch. The ditch never gets dug because they're trying to figure out which shovel's best. Now, I wrote Factions for that very purpose too, to look at that problem. I don't care what you believe about 9/11. I don't care what you believe about the Oklahoma City bombing. I do care about what I believe about both of them, and they probably disagree with you. However, if restoration of constitutional government is the intent of all of us, the objective of all of us, we need to focus on that and not allow distractions from the commitment to that for purpose, unless we want to work only with people that agree with us on one of these lesser factions. We don't need to start fights. We're not going to convince the other guy. Does God exist? No, he can't, because I can't see him. Yes, he does. No, I believe it, and that's all there is to it. There's no sense going there.
There's no
And
meeting of the minds, basically,
there's
yeah.
no meeting of the mind, so why go there? Stick with the people that believe what you want to believe. And focus on that principal faction. The faction of the United States is a wonderful country. The Constitution might need a little revision, but it's an unbelievable document, and the government created by it, if it's in obedience to the Constitution, is probably the best government in the world, bar none. So then we can focus on that and not spend our time in pissing contests with each other.
Something you also brought up a little bit earlier, I just want to touch upon real briefly. You mentioned the, I guess you were alluding to the contradictions between some of these myths that I guess what one could call a cognitive dissonance. And I think like two of them particularly, one of them being, of course, the corporate United States myth, the other one being the Philadelphia conspiracy. And since the Philadelphia conspiracy, just in terms of the chronology, the sequence of events here, that one had to occur before the corporate United States. And so that it kind of almost doesn't make sense if you were to try and assume that, for example, what if both of them were true? I don't see how that's even possible.
Well, I don't see how it is. If it was evil from the beginning, why would they have to make it evil later?
Or more evil, maybe. Or yeah,
It
it's
would
starting to
have to have
really
been
not.
good at the beginning and made evil in 1871. It would have been good in 1787, bad in 1871, or it was bad in 1787, and there was no need for 1871. Yes. What's behind this? But people don't understand. They'll argue both points depending on which side of the room they're in. If we're talking about corporate United States, they'll argue corporate United States. If we're talking about Philadelphia conspiracy, the same people will argue the Philadelphia conspiracy. And that is what cognitive dissonance? Yes, it is. Absolutely, without a doubt. How can you believe one that contradicts the other? Or how can you believe the other that contradicts the one? And I wouldn't doubt in some cases there's probably A, B, and C, maybe even D, F, and none of the above. So.
Well, I something that kind of really just makes me cringe is the fact that, at least with a lot of folks I come across, is that more of the patriots, just on average, at least from the ones I've come across, seem to be more familiar with something like the corporate United States myth than they would be about something real like the administrative agencies. So to even just even have a conversation with them about administrative agencies, usually the first response I get is, "What do you mean by administrative agencies?" But if I say corporate United States or any of this other stuff, they're like, "Oh yeah,
Oh,
I know what you're
everybody
talking
knows
about."
what that. Yeah, I know what that is, and I know what the color yellow is, and I know that Mickey Mouse has two big ears. yes, unfortunately, within the Patriot community, truth may be stranger than fiction. But I wrote I've got to rewrite it because it focuses on habeas corpus at the beginning, but the article I wrote, Habeas Corpus, The Guardian of Liberty, was years of 2 years of study, not 8 hours a day or anything like that, 16 hours a day, but over a period of 2 years, talking with friends who had some interest in legal matters and dealing primarily with enactments by the legislature and Supreme Court or other court decisions to find out what had gone wrong in this country. And there's no doubt that administrative agencies are the source of this because they're not bound by the Constitution. They're not bound by the rules. The Supreme Court in 1936 in Ashwander versus TVA basically said, go at yourselves. We won't rule on the constitutionality unless we have to. We'll rule on the way you wrote the rules, but we won't compare it to the Constitution. We'll just make sure that it's clear and concise meaning that you wrote in the rules. That's what happened at the Bundy Ranch. And then a few years later, that was 1838, and in 1849, 1938, 1946, the Administrative Agencies Act, they admitted in the congressional record that they created a fourth branch of government. Now, how does it get down to us? Well, the court ignores the Constitution because those agencies can write rules, but those rules apply in 1817, the 10 square miles that I mentioned earlier, or 432, the territories or land owned by the United States. However, we're tricked into believing that they apply to us, and that is was explained in a Supreme Court decision in, I think, 1870s or 80s. That's in the article where the court defines that once there's executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government in a state or in a territory, that interim, the transitional part between a territory governed by the Washington and statehood. They create the administrative, executive, and judicial, then they create a constitution, submit the constitution, and then they're expected into statehood. But once those three branches, executive, legislative, and judicial, exist even within a territory, the jurisdiction of the United States Congress ceases under 432, Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2 of the Constitution. Very clear. So that article lays out, I think, irrefutably. Nobody's been able to refute it. They'll argue that it's not correct, but they won't tell me what's wrong with it. They'll say it's the
That's just
corporate United
amazing.
States, but they won't tell me what's wrong with what I wrote. So, hey, what can I do? They'll either understand it or not. But I believe that what I've presented in that article does explain, and you've read it, and it does explain how they created the circumstances that we exist under today.
There was a, I'm trying to remember right offhand, it was a Soviet defector from the 80s, I believe, who said something I think is quite
Oh,
relevant regarding.
yeah, you brought my attention to that a while back, and I think this is phenomenal. It will say 25 years, but in fact, it was over 50 years ago. And he's going to mention a guy named Andropov, who was the chairman of the Central Committee of the Communist Party in Russia at the time. This is from an interview by G. Edward Griffin, who wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island, a very good explanation of what happened beginning in 1910 with the financial structure, the economic structure of this country. But the interview was done in 1984, so he's going back to 25 years, 1960s, and or 1959. And if we look back at our history, the comfortable period after World War II, through the end of the 40s and into the 50s, was the American dream. But somewhere in the 60s, things started drifting away from that. So I see his timing is correct. But I'm going to read a portion of that interview because, and listen closely. The demoralization process in the United States is basically completed already. for the last 25 years, actually, it is overfulfilled because demoralization now reaches such areas where previously not even Comrade Andropov and all his experts could ever have dreamed of such a tremendous success. Most of it is done by Americans to Americans, thanks to a lack of moral standards. As I mentioned before, exposure to true information does not matter anymore. A person who is demoralized is unable to assess true information. Let me stop right there. Demoralized. Oh, believing all these mythologies. I'm demoralized. There's nothing we can do. There's no solution associated with that. Okay, back to Yuri Bezmenov. As I mentioned before, exposure to true information does not matter anymore. A person who is demoralized is unable to assess true information. The facts tell nothing to him. Even if I shower him with information, with authentic proof, with documents, with pictures, even if I take him by force, now he's going to use the Soviet Union for an example, to the Soviet Union and show him concentration camps, he will refuse to believe it until he receives a kick in his fat bottom. When the military boot crashes, then he will understand. But not before that. That is the tragedy of the situation of demoralization. So, basically, America is stuck with demoralization, and unless, even if you start right now, here, this minute, start creating a new generation of Americans, it will still take you 15 to 20 years to turn the tide of ideological perception of reality back to normalcy and patriotism. What he said is we're demoralized. We've been demoralized. And this goes back, and I've lived the era. I was born in 46. I've lived it. We have been demoralized. We've got all this conflict. The civil rights movement was one of the, and women's rights movements, and the anti-war, Vietnam anti-war movement, ran together through the late early 60s, or the early mid 60s, into the 70s. And it was a demoralization because it said your government's wrong. Your constitution's wrong. Because for a century and a half now, we've not had equality. And we've going around killing people. This demoralization process began. It's continued. It's grown since then. And so now we're so demoralized that we have trouble with the truth. And we spend our time looking for monsters that don't exist rather than accepting the truth. Now, if we accept the truth, can we get back to where we should be in 15 to 20 years? Or can enough of us get back to the truth now to begin working on a solution? But that demoralization precludes the solution. Because nothing works, everything's wrong, and all we're doing is looking for fault and blaming somebody else. We ought to blame ourselves for not looking for a solution, rather looking for problems. How many problems do I need before I know there's a problem and I got to find a solution?
Right.
And, you know, so we continue. Every year we stack more problems on top of the problems, on top of the problems, on top of the problems, and we can't even see the top of the pile, and nobody, very few people are seeking a solution. And when the solution comes, hey, let's get 1 million militia members, we'll go to Washington, and we'll hang those bastards. Oh, well, that's not a solution. That's a death wish. But there are solutions. The plan for restoration of constitutional government might not be the best. But as Randy Mack said, that's the only plan on the table because everybody else just talks in generalities.
And these empty platitudes and so forth, which is really irritating to me. And you're right. You know, this mythology is used to deflect what would otherwise have been productive conversations away from any sort of real solutions or even viable options. So, for example, some examples of like false solutions would be something like a Noaikar or A4V, something more along those lines, as opposed to historically provable solutions that have worked before, that you were kind of alluding to, like committees of safety and militia.
Well, that NORAD Corps, you explained that to me, and I'm sorry, I'm getting old. I don't recall it, but brief me on that NORAD Corps.
Sure, of course. This is a little bit obscure, but the people who promote, mythologists who promote things like corporate United States, this is more up their alley. That acronym stands for a term called a notice of understanding and intent and a claim of right. The idea behind this document is to purportedly to deny the consent to be governed.
Oh,
In other words,
you've
to
got
just say.
enough. Claim of right. That's good. That claim of right. I've got to claim rights that are protected in the Constitution. No, I don't. I have those rights if I'm willing to defend them. Begin there. I cannot go to the government that took my rights away and say, "Give me my rights back." I can go to the government and say, "I have my rights. Try and take them away." So these people are trying to say, "Give them back," and I'm saying, "You ain't going to take them away from me." That's the solution. Don't let them be taken away.
Right, and unfortunately, this supposed notice and claim of right or whatever kind of incorporates other things. Kind of something you mentioned earlier about the incorrect use of liens and so forth, like filing these fee schedules where you're billing the police officers who abuse you and so forth. It's kind of this weird compendium of things, and then of course there's the A4V, which is accepted
Well,
for value.
let's go back to before we get to A4V. So let's see. The police protect the cops, so the cops will protect the. I'm sorry. The cops will. The courts will protect the cops because the cops protect the courts. So I'm going to go with the claim against the cops to the courts that are protected by those cops, and I'm going to expect them to punish those cops for treating me the way they treated me. And then I'm going to go to the cops with an arrest warrant so they arrest that court because that court wouldn't arrest the cops and give me restitution for what they did to me. Now, if you want to fight two battles at once with no ammunition, hey, jump into it.
Right. And A4V, accepted for value in a lot of ways, is very similar. It's you can tap into the super secret bank account at the Treasury Department at the
Yeah.
Washington, D.C. that no one has access to.
And generally, it relies heavily, if not completely, on the presumption that the Uniform Commercial Code is the law of the land.
Yeah, both of them do. Both
Right.
both things do.
Now, to the
So
best of my knowledge, the federal statutes, I have yet to find a Uniform Commercial Code variation in there. But however, if I go to the states that I've looked into, and the first one I did it in was Florida. That there's a variation of the Uniform Commercial Code, and it's in Florida statutes. I think it begins at 501. I don't recall now, it was years ago. But then the numbers are nearly identical with the UCC all the way through. However, they've changed a few things in it, and they've taken away some of the rights of the consumer and given more strength to the commercial interests. But you cannot argue UCC in court because it's not the law of the land. You can argue Florida Statute Section 531 or something like that, but you can't argue UCC in court. On the federal level, you can't because they haven't even adopted it because they don't work on that level with us. They don't deal with commercial contracts on the federal level. That's a state issue. So the
right.
states have adopted UCC. To the extent that they've adopted them. The one thing principle in UCC that most people don't understand is UCC fills in the blanks that aren't filled in by a contract. And it said, in fact, it says in UCC, I believe, I recall this, that if there's a written, a type contract, and there's a handwritten change and both parties initial that, that written part supersedes the type part. Now, looking at the structure, if I forget to talk about when a payment is accepted received, then I can go to UCC and it says postmark date is date of payment. But if it's in the contract, it can supersede that because we agreed on those terms. So if I agree that I'm going to pay X dollars by the 15th of the month and it will be delivered to the lender, UCC doesn't matter. And that contract's enforceable because it's specific to that point. So that applies to everything. If it's in the contract, UCC doesn't matter. So you can't go buy a truck and then try and argue your way out by, this for value bit by saying UCC says I can do this. No, because the contract you signed supersedes that. So you've got UCC as adopted by the state, then you've got the written contract, then you've got modifications of the written contract recognized by both parties. Neither party signed the UCC. Both parties signed the written contract, type contract, and both parties initialed the changes in that contract. So common sense dictates that that contract, unless there's an omission or something that isn't addressed that can be resolved by the contract, there is no reversion back to the UCC to fill in the gaps created by the absence or omission in the contract. So these guys, a lot of guys have gone to jail thinking that, well, there was a guy in Florida. He went out and bought a truck and he used UCC to argue he didn't have to pay. He wrote some instrument, gave it to them, they accepted it. And he was either going to restitute them or go to jail, and he went to jail. This was back in the 80s, late 80s. No, I'm sorry, late 90s. It was after I left Florida. So, you follow these trails, and you're liable to have a very detrimental effect on your own future and your property. You're going to be giving it away to cover the cost that the damage that you've imposed on somebody else. But what are these false solutions? They emit from these mythologies. The mythology of UCC in this. It's not the law. It
Right,
was
and
written by, I don't remember the name of the organization, but they wrote it as a fundamental recommendation for contracts and a fallback if that specific element was missing from the contract. That's all it was. Most states, if not all, adopted it in one form or another as a backup, but not to supersede the contract that you agreed to, read, agreed to, and signed.
correct. And not only that, but the United States Treasury's Office of Inspector General explicitly said that they consider A4V to be a scam. And remember, the whole claim about line A4V is that it's supposed to be a legal remedy. And so in that sense, it very much mirrors what you mentioned earlier about the lien issue. Especially there was that court case, I believe it was United States versus Marsh back in 1998, where the judge said, I memorized this because I thought it was astounding. The judge said, quote, the filing of the lien is the crime,
Yeah,
close
the act
quote.
of the filing of the lien is the crime.
Yep.
Yep.
So, I mean, there's actually proof that demonstrating. But then, of course, again, the problem when we're talking with the Patriots and all that about, what's real and what's not, again, if I mention accepted for value, they'll know what I'm talking about. But if I mention something real, like committees of safety, well, what's that? And it's kind of hard to have those
Well, let's go
conversations.
back to Marsh, and this is kind of interesting because people say, well, the judge didn't rule correctly. He was wrong with that. There was no crime committed when I filed the lien. So let's look at the effect of a lien. I'm a surveyor. I used to file liens. If somebody didn't pay me within the prescribed time, I had 60 days to file a lien. So if they didn't pay me at net 30, then I'd file a lien on their property. I'd release the lien when I got paid. But that lien was based on a value that was an agreed by contract. There are other forms of lien that are based on a judgment from a court. You can lien somebody's property if you get a judgment for $10,000. You can lien his property for $10,000. Not 20, not the value of the property, but for $10,000. But these people want to look at a bond that's held for, say, $3 million. And they want to attach the whole bond, but there's no legitimacy to the claim absent proof of an obligation, which is a contract or a judgment against them. And so they say the judge ruled incorrectly in this, but is the guy damaged? Why is it a crime? Because if we get back to justice, a crime is when somebody's injured or their property damaged as a consequence of your actions. So let's say this is a judge, and he makes good money, but he spends it all, he's got it invested, but he wants to buy a bigger and better house and keep the old one and rent it out. So he goes down to buy a $500,000 house, and his credit would handle the $500,000 house, $500,000 house, but he goes down to the bank and he says, I want to borrow money to buy this house. And then they do the title search and they say, well, you've got a lien for $3 million. Well, he's got the financial wherewithal to justify borrowing that $500,000 to buy the house, but because of this lien, he can't borrow it, because if they loaned it to him, the lender would have to give it to pay off the lien, or at least that portion of the lien. So you have taken away his right to do what everybody should have a right to do, to borrow money to buy something. Not that I do. I have a right to, but I don't do that. But if you have a credit card, you're borrowing money to buy something. If you want to buy a house or a car, you go to the lender. If there's a lien against you, you can't buy the car. You can't buy the house. So he is injured. You've taken away his right to borrow money, so you have damaged him. That's why the ruling in U.S. v. Marsh said that it's a crime at filing, because the lending institutions are bound to recognize liens of record.
Sure, and you know, you need to have a good credit rating in order to borrow money and so forth. But yeah, in terms of the effects of patriot mythology, you know, this this kind of reminds me too of something that of an archetype that I think really encapsulates this well. I think Claire Wolfe wrote something, but I think it was back in, geez, what was it, 2005, back when Bush Jr. was in office. And
yeah, you read that to me, and I think you ought to read it.
Okay, fine. Let me see if I can find it real quickly. Okay, here we go. So this is what Claire Wolfe wrote. Quote, "Reactive Ralphie knows, or thinks he knows, exactly what we should all do. Drop everything. Write your Congress thing. Come to the rally. Email an alert. Send this article to everyone you know. Study the 2,000 pages of astounding documented facts I've assembled on my website. Send a contribution. Sign the petition. Support a patriot in need. Take a stand. Do something. Now, 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 now." And Ralphie means that each and every one of us should do all of the above, all day long, all lifelong, in response to every bit of tyrannical male bovine product that plops out of the internet or governmental sphincter.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's perfect, isn't it?
That's it. The solution is, you know, hit that like button over and over and over again, and don't forget to share it every time you have an opportunity, and that will change the world. There is no doubt about that. What needs to be shared is legitimate information so that we understand what the problem is, and legitimate information with regard to what the possible solution to the problem is. We don't need to chase monsters. Create monsters and then chase them.
Well, I mean, in a sense, this is kind of really all begging the question, you know, who, I guess what some people would call key bono, but Gary, who really benefits from the promotion of this mythology?
Well, I think I alluded to it before when I was talking about the drone strike, that who benefits from this? The government does, without a doubt, because if they can create division, and here Sun Tzu was absolutely on, because this is a very general overview, at least that portion, he goes into detail, but when he said divide and conquer. You know, I read a lot about the Civil War and the Revolutionary War, and the Civil War, quite often, when Stonewall Jackson was alive, he was a master at this. He could divide the forces and effectively defeat the enemy. But he was probably the only general that could always succeed at dividing his forces to defeat the enemy, and Lee relied on him. I think Lee's quote was, Jackson lost it before Jackson died. Jackson lost his left arm, and I've lost my right arm. If Jackson had been at Gettysburg, I'm not sure that the Union forces would have won the battle. But that divide and conquer is effective, because it spreads your forces too thin, and that it subjects you to defeat. In the military context, in this case, it keeps us from working together. The same effect. We cannot work. If there's 10 million patriots and they're going in four different directions on one subject, we've got 2.5 million average in each of these elements. Now, within those elements, what if they're divided on at least just one issue they're divided on? Now we're down to 1,250,000. And so we keep getting smaller and smaller groups as this division permeates our ranks. We might agree on one thing, but we don't agree on another, so we're going to disagree. We can't work together. The Maryland Resolves, do you have that in front of you, Sleepy? I think that.
I think I can pull it up right
Why don't
quick.
you pull that up? But understand that the more divided we are, the less effective. In fact, we're at a point that we're ineffective, absolutely ineffective at this point. We can't do a damn thing. We did something last April. They did something October of last year. October of last year, a number of people went to Washington to go to the World War II Veterans Memorial, and it was barricaded. They weren't waving signs. They were picking up barricades, taking them down to the White House, and dumping them against the fence. That was resistance of sorts. April of, that was 2013. April 2014, we moved into defiance, where people, rather than getting arrested, were facing getting shot by holding their arms against the government. But then we're back in the doldrums again. We're back where there's no wind. We can't move now. We're in the doldrums right now, and there's nothing that can be done because everybody's back on Facebook, role-playing, creating pissing contests, and doing everything they can from fighting the real enemy by
Oh, what's
fighting
that term?
amongst themselves.
What was that term you used to? I think it was like what, something about monsters or bringing up monsters or
Well,
bringing something like that.
this goes back and again researching history and looking at some old maps. There are a number of old maps that showed Europe and Africa fairly accurately, but to the left side of that map, there were waves and ships on the sea, and way over on the left, where the world dropped off and the water just poured out of the ocean like a waterfall, there were also monsters there. And so they created monsters, and some of them would say, there be monsters here. Not just drawing them, they'd actually put a note out there, there'll be monsters here. So nobody was willing to go there because there were monsters there. And so they created the monsters because of the unknown that was out there. Now, it's not an unknown, but it's an unaccepted that we create monsters about now. For example, back to the article, Habeas Corpus, Guardian Liberty, and the substantial proof, not pulling in UCC that's not a law or any some theory of claim of right. Why do I have to claim what's mine? But in fact, showing court decisions and enactments by Congress that demonstrate what's happened, that's not a monster. But the UCC is a monster because it doesn't exist in the context that they're putting it in. The claim of right is a monster because if I claim a right, it means that I have begun from the premise that I have been denied that right. And if I accept that it's been denied, what if they refuse the claim? It remains denied. So unless I assert that I have that right, I don't have that right by my own admission.
That document you wanted me to pull up, the resolution of the Maryland deputies, the Maryland
Yeah,
resolves
this is okay. Go ahead. Yeah.
from December 12th of 1774. Part of it says, quote, "Resolved unanimously is our opposition to the subtle plan of the British administration to enslave America, will be strengthened by a union of all ranks of men in this province. We do most earnestly recommend that all former differences about religion or politics and all private animosities and quarrels of every kind from henceforth cease and be forever buried in oblivion. And we entreat, we conjure every man by his duty to God, his country, and his posterity cordially to unite in defense of our common rights and liberties." Close quote. So
Okay,
yeah, I
now,
think that kind of says it all about being burying it forever in oblivion.
yeah, the only omission on that is he said, and see, they didn't have this problem back then, so the omission was is understood. But they say differences religious and political. We've got this new one in here, and for the most part, it evolves from the patriot mythologies we've talked about, primarily corporate United States, Uniform Commercial Code being the law of the land. The Philadelphia conspiracy, things like this, and it's called legal remedies. So today we would have to add religious, political, and legal remedies, because those are the the legal remedies is the monster of our own creation as a solution to the problem. But yes, we have to work together in the whole article factions. is based upon the premise that we need to find the common element and commit ourselves to that common faction, that principal faction, if we want to achieve our goal.
Well, just to kind of round this out a bit, I mean, is there anybody else who benefits from the promotion of patriot mythology then?
Well, yes, probably everybody that perpetuates these. You know, the one that I know Randy liked the term useful idiots, but I don't. I think if we want people to work with us, we can't call them names, but I call them the guess what I know people. They read something or part of something and they say, hey, this is great. I really like this. And so then they start spreading it around. They become, in a sense, a tool of the government, like Mr. X would be a tool of government bringing it through the vortex into the realm of the patriot community. Guess what I know says, hey, guess what I know? And they post this stuff and they start perpetuating it. And this is where you can get thousands of occurrences. And then somebody will say, oh, I read it 17, 18 times, so it must be true. So, but theirs is just a... Well, they probably come in three breakdowns in the guess what I know mentality. One is ego gratification. Oh, everybody's so proud of me because I brought this to their attention. My head's just, I've got to get a new hat. Two is gullibility. They're led by the nose, that they believe it to be true, and they're passing it on with a very sincere concern that everybody should know this. And the third element in the guess what I know mentality, let's call it news junkies or role-playing, and they're acting as, well, another one, carousel of carnivores. They're acting as if I'm a very knowledgeable person and I'm an authority and I'm passing this on information on to you for your own good. But they're the one, that last element is the ones that have... are trying to emulate Alex Jones. I hate to put it that way, but they're trying to act a role of importance. They want to be the greatest newsman since Walter Cronkite. Trouble is, they don't know what news is. Walter Cronkite understood the 5 W's: who, what, why, where, when. These guys, you know, if you listen to them, they might say what. Mm-hmm. They might even have a who in there. They usually won't have a when unless somebody has affixed a date to it. Where, hey, they might be able to get close on that one. And what was the one I'm missing now?
I guess why, perhaps.
Why? Why it's happening. Oh, the why. Now, the why is quite simple because, you know, I hate to mention Joyce Riley's name. I will. Randy Mack was going to do a radio show on corporate United States, and I made some notes, and they're posted on the internet, and we'll provide a link to them. And this has to do with corporate United States. The two arguments, the two principal arguments to support the proof of the existence of the corporate United States. So we were talking. Randy wanted me to interview with her to see if she should go on the show. And so I made these notes, and we were a three-way conversation on Skype, and we're talking about it, and I asked her if she had written an article about corporate United States. And I said, you have the source documents. For example, you have a copy of the Act of 1871 creating what you call the corporate United States. She said, well, no. I said, have you read the whole thing? Well, I've read parts of it. What about the Title 18? Have you read that? Well, I've read that, yes, and that says that this is true. And I said, well, you said you were a researcher, but you don't even have the source documents to explain what you're doing. And she said, well, I read other articles, and then I rewrite them in my own words.
Oh, no.
She admitted it. She claimed to be a researcher, and what she's doing is taking these proliferation of stories and finding some that are the same, maybe a few that have been Joyce Riley'd and written differently. And she recompiles them back into her words, her take on the subject matter, without even going back to the sources that she refers to in her documentation.
Well, that's just being lazy.
Oh, no, she's a researcher.
Yeah, careless too, apparently.
But she's playing a role. She wants attention for this. She got disappointed. She didn't want to go on the show after that interview, and Randy didn't want her on the show, so it worked out quite well. At least that wasn't propagated. I don't know where she is now, but that's the kind of person that is seeking this role playing, that I'm important and I've done the research and look at how important I am, and I've done the research, and look at how important I am, and I've done the research. Now listen to me and believe what I say. So those are the three kinds of guess what I knows, at least the way I, but maybe at this point I can only categorize the three types. The ego gratification, hey, you're good. You're not trying for the broad audience. You're looking for your friends to like what you posted and pat you on the back. The gullible, those that really believe it because it just sounds like what I want to hear. And
Yeah,
the
especially if you can click that infamous button on Facebook, right?
Yeah. And then the role players are the ones that are trying to self-promote themselves into positions of authority as authoritative sources, experts. That 42 something org that was on the other night. I've worked with Brian March back in beginning in 94, and in 95 we published probably the most thorough book on the missing 13th Amendment for decades. Now more research is coming out where we can fill in some of the gaps, but for the most part, nothing has really changed since that was written in 95. But some guy who probably didn't know what the missing 13th Amendment was a year or two ago describes himself on their page as 13th Amendment expert. I don't even claim to be an expert on it. I'm probably more knowledgeable than all but about 5 or 10 people in the country, but I'm not an expert. Who's an expert on something like that? We don't know too much to call ourselves experts, but we're researchers and we've developed what we can to provide at least a very good presentation of the entire experience from ratification to demise of and to in case of Brian Marsh, where we corresponded with Congressional Research Organization and politicians and legal staff in Washington and showed the contradictions of their articles. But I don't know, truth is truth, and if you find the right source, you can get the truth. And if you don't find the right source, you're going to get, well,
Misled.
fair to say.
Well, is there anyone else who benefits from promoting this mythology?
Well, I think there's some people out there that are trying to make a living or increase their livelihood by this, and they're the ones with the PayPal buttons all over their page. And you go to their pages, you go to their page, and after about 2 seconds, there's a pop-up badge, and you got to close that because it's just darkened the whole screen, and you can't even read what you went to see because there's this pop-up ad. And you close that, and on the left column and the right column, there's all these ads. And what do they call them? Click to pay or click, I don't know what they call them. But if you click that and go to that page, they make penny, 3 cents, 5 cents, 10 cents. I don't know what
It's a
they spend
kick,
that.
it's a kickback.
It's a
Sometimes they'll
kickback.
refer to it as a referral program, but it's a kickback.
Now, some people might do that to sustain the cost of their internet access, the domain name, and they're keeping their page up. But others, I believe, are trying to make a living off the damn thing. And those ones that are trying to make the living off of the damn thing will quite often take an event, say the Texas Border Operations, and they'll be collecting money for the Texas Border Operations. But of course, the Texas Border Operations, oh, that was very expensive, me covering that from my armchair. And so that $20,000 I raised, that bought me a new armchair because I wore the old one out, a new truck because I got to go into town and get my beer. And so all the money disappears, or maybe a little of it might filter down to where it was. Good example of that, and this is not an individual, but it was Oath Keepers. They admitted to raising, I think, $42,000, and I think $12,000 to $15,000 might be provably have been provided to the Bundys and or to support the operations there. But a lot of that went to equipment that left in the pockets of the Oath Keepers when they bailed out. So the profit motive or just sustaining. I don't have a job. I get my welfare or unemployment check, but I need a little more money. So I guess they could both be wrapped in the profit motive, a minimum profit and a maximum profit. But they're doing it primarily so they can put those buttons up there and get their PayPal account online and try and make a living with misinformation or disinformation.
So, I guess a patriot for profit, perhaps.
Well, that's probably a very accurate and old term. I mean, that one goes back to the 80s because people were selling these packages for $500 that'll get you out of your problems with the Internal Revenue Service service. And quite often it did because when you're in prison, you don't have to worry about the IRS.
Right, and something else I've noticed too is that a lot of times the guess what I knows will a lot of times be followers of these Patriots for Profit, and they'll when they see like an article or actually not even that because remember they don't read too much. Let's say a video, right? It'll be like a 5-minute video or what have you. And they see like, ooh, this is neat, and then next thing you know, it's share, share, share on Facebook or wherever else. And wow, this is the latest new thing. This is absolutely fantastic. And we have to do something or not do something, as the case may be. And next thing you know, it's the whole reactive Ralphie thingy one more time. But then, of course, whatever. But then, of course, the Patriot for Profit in question, who released said video, well, got to donate to him, right? Support alternative media, or so they claim. Next thing you know. Wow, it's like, oh, well, I now have a legal defense fund, and oh, wait, well, I didn't pay the lawyer either, Yeah, shucks, that lack of accountability. So let me get this straight. A lot of us are in this because government's being bad and violating our rights and so forth. And then all of a sudden, somebody who claims to be one of us basically comes along and says, hey, I want to collect money for this purpose, but I'm not going to tell you where the money is. No transparency here. And if you question me, you're fed.
Yeah.
I love that little con game, don't you?
Well, there's another one, and this is one that I ran into, oh, 3, 4, 5 years ago. Somebody met an RTR a long time ago, and I'll refer to that person as LR. LR had read the Red State Amendment and was enthused about it. LR could get a commercial driver's license and do all kinds of things, but she had to get the entire program. She had bought the book, and she had to get the entire program now to really understand it and be able to do it. And she was hopeful that she would get it, but she didn't make enough money to pay the whole thing off. So, hey, here's the deal. I'll tell you what, for every person you sign up, I will give you credit for $50 or $100 towards your purchase. I think it was $800 that was needed to buy the whole package, not the book, because you had to buy that already. Maybe you got credit for the book out of the 800, but at 50 or 75 or $100 a shot, you sign up enough people. And I'll give you the package. You get credit towards the purchase. So, it's in a way kind of a pyramid scheme or a cosmetic scheme or something like that. So there are different ways of either getting your money out of your pocket, or if you don't have your money, we'll give you a way to get other people's money out of their pocket so that you don't have to get money out of your pocket.
Right, and
By the way,
something
she never did get the commercial license last I spoke with her.
oh, surprise, surprise. Well, I mean, something you were kind of alluding to earlier, at least with Miss Riley, is I don't know, just a lot of punditry and all that, and a lot of ways. While there might be a place for that, maybe perhaps someday somewhere, I mean, that's not news, right? I mean, at that point, it would be more like the gossip column or the rumor mill.
Well, let's see, in a library, they break books up between fiction and nonfiction, right?
Yep, they
Okay,
do.
imagine 10 acres of library and only one shelf of nonfiction and all the rest is fiction. That's about the ratio in the Patriot community of what we have. I would say that there are probably 1,000 fictions to one nonfiction.
Yeah, I won't argue with that. Well, how disastrous do you think is this ripple effect?
Well, let's see. People should recognize this quote. If you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. That was George Goebbels, Minister of Propaganda for Adolf Hitler. If you tell a lie big enough, the bigger the better, because now I separate myself from reality. And hey, I've got the perfect scapegoat for all your problems. And keep repeating it. People will eventually come to believe it. And I think human nature and what we've discussed kind of dictates that that is the reality for whatever reason, whether they just accept the information presented or they're participants in the distribution for profit or for ego or for any other purpose, they are helping that tell that big lie, corporate United States, Philadelphia conspiracy, UCC, whatever it is. They are telling a big enough lie so far from the truth that it's unbelievable. Oh, no, so far from the truth that it's believable. And it's repeated enough. Share, like, share, like, share, like. Here's an email distribution list that puts this stuff out. People will eventually come to believe it.
Yeah, unfortunately. Well, what solutions or at least options do we have at our disposal to deal with this scourge of patriot mythology?
Well, one is to be skeptical. Let's go back to 6 million Russian or Chinese or whatever, I don't, Martian troops. What the hell? I don't not, well, that's not fair because I don't know how much they eat. So we'll stick to the Russians and Chinese. Chinese eat less than the Russian. You know, it's mostly rice. But there, I went to college, junior college, a long, long time ago, back in the 60s. But one of my classes, I had to learn the logical fallacies, and there were seven of them. This goes back for centuries that these logical fallacies exist. And if we understand them and we look at what's being presented to us objectively, perhaps we can identify these fallacies. That means not truths, these fallacies. So I'm going to go through the seven of them to give you an idea. And all you have to do is search on the internet for logical fallacies to begin to understand what they are if you want more into them. The first one is non sequitur. It does not therefore follow. Now, an example of that is the truthful statement, all squares are rectangles. But because of that, you cannot assume that all rectangles are squares. So the following, that all rectangles are squares, cannot be assumed from all squares are rectangles. A rectangle is a four-sided object. A square is four equal sides. So one doesn't follow the other. So if what they say, they try and incorporate, bring more into the picture than is defined by the original statement. They're trying to get you to follow that this is true because I told you agree that that is true. Now I'm trying to get you to believe this is true. Another one is argument from ignorance. It assumes that a claim is true because it has not been or cannot be proven false, or vice versa. Now, I don't know, Sleepy, can you think of a demonstration of that?
Sure, I think I can improv one real quick. Let's see. The argument from ignorance. Well, let's see. I don't know too much about quantum mechanics, so therefore, there's no way we can know about anything or something to that effect. We don't know something, right?
Well,
So.
let's go a little further. The moon's made out of blue cheese, or green cheese. Green cheese, right? Isn't it green cheese? Yes. Well, that's true. I mean, look at the moon. It looks like green cheese. And there's no way we can prove it false. Now we can, but back historically, people thought the moon was made out of cheese. It had the characteristics, it had the bubble holes in it and everything else. And since there was nothing to disprove that, it was accepted by a lot of people, just like walking under a ladder, crossing the path of a black cat. There was no way to disprove these. So that's from ignorance, because we don't know enough about the subject to understand how we can disprove it.
Right.
Next is argument from incredulity. I cannot imagine how this could be true, therefore it must be false. Administrative agencies are the problem. No, they can't be true because there's a I can't imagine how that could be true because, you know, the courts defend the Constitution, and so that must be false.
Yeah, pretty much.
Argument from repetition. Oh, there's Goebbels again. signifies that it has been discussed extensively until nobody cares to discuss it anymore. So that goes beyond Goebbels. It goes to Goebbels' conclusion. Sleepy, I'm going to let you bring this. You can talk about John Doe 4 to explain this one.
Okay, John Doe 4 recap really quickly. Oh, let's see. Okay, so
single source.
I know, single source. There was a guy, Mr. William Cooper, Bill Cooper, and he was claiming that you were somehow involved with the Murrah Building bombing back in 1995, and it's this silly old story about Gary. Identified as this John Doe 4, when in fact you had two material eyewitnesses, Larry Beecraft and Charles Tobias, who basically said that you were in outside a courthouse in Florida. So unless you could somehow very quickly travel from Florida all the way over to Oklahoma that morning, then it's kind of impossible. But the truth doesn't matter, of course, when it comes to Patriot mythology, because as you can quite see, oh boy, you're John Doe 4 because Bill Cooper said so. And Bill Cooper, promotes a bunch of other things. I think somebody once even said he was a truther, perhaps.
Well, let's go a little further. Before we did that radio show, how many hits did we find Gary Hunt, John Doe 4, OKC bombing?
Oh, gosh, I think it was in the hundreds of thousands at least.
Okay, so the repetition was so great that people accepted it absolutely.
Yep, pretty much.
So there was on the outpost-of-freedom.com radio, there's a link to the John Doe 4 radio show. And if you listen to that, you'll get an idea of how the repetition works. And it wasn't until 17 years later that I decided it was time to pull Larry Beecraft out of the closet because I was with him that morning. To rebut this thing. But that repetition went into the tens or hundreds of thousands. And so the more I see, the more I have proof. Even though the wording is exact, I got it from 17 sources or 3,000 sources. And the wording's the same in every source. But those are different sources. So there's the repetition perpetuated into truth.
And especially considering what Joyce Riley admitted, remember, she didn't check her sources. So why would anyone who repeated this stuff, that ripple effect, why would they ever trace it back to the source, namely Mr. Cooper? They wouldn't. That's the whole
Bill
point.
Cooper said it, I believe it, and that's all there is to it.
All the ones who bothered to even track it back, as many people didn't.
That's true.
Yeah.
Next is the argument from silence. This is where a conclusion is based on the absence of evidence rather than the existence of evidence. You can't prove it to be true. Therefore, you can't prove it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about you proving that it's false? See, that argument does work both ways.
But you tried proving a negative.
Yeah, but see that now you've created a pissing contest. Well, my father can kick your father's ass. No, my father can kick your father's ass. Well, which one's true? Which one's false?
Yeah, good luck proving a negative. It's not going to happen.
Until we get the fathers together, which is very unlikely, we're never going to find out what the truth is. Argument to moderation. It's called a false compromise or middle ground, fallacy of the main, argumentum ad tempor. I don't speak Latin very well. Argumentum ad temperantium. This assumes that the compromise between the two positions is always correct. Now, the interesting thing about that is that assumes that most people can understand that there are shades of gray. Mm-hmm. But if they can't understand that there might be a middle ground, they're going to hold firm to their belief. So it's never resolved because nobody's willing to take a middle ground. Somebody steps in and says, well, maybe this part of that is true and that part of this is true. But nobody's going to accept that because they want the absolute on their side. They don't want to lose this battle. It's a human nature. You know, I'm on the bandwagon. I don't want to get off the bandwagon. And you're not going to get me off. And it's a slow process. And it's not quite that argument of moderation, but well, maybe it is. Back in 1993 in Waco, Texas, there is video footage of a tank using the barrel of the tank to push a hole in the front wall of the Mount Carmel Church. As it backs out, there's a bright triangular, elongated triangular, a shiny object on the side of the plant, tank, and it's described by the narrator to be a flamethrower, flamethrowing tank, flamethrower on the tank. That was Linda Thompson's Waco, the Big Lie. And everybody in the Patriot community said they had a flamethrowing tank. Almost everybody. I'd looked at it when I got back to Waco, and I saw that there were some problems here. One, the timestamp on the footage put it, I'm trying to remember now, at least 25 minutes, maybe 45 minutes before the fire started. Now, the building burned to the ground in 15 minutes, so how can you start a fire with a flamethrowing tank in a building that's made out of old wood with dried wood with oil-based paint on it, use a flamethrower on it, and have the fire not really start for another 25 to 45 minutes? Two, is the fact that the flamethrowers that I've seen in the military, when you turn them off, especially, there are two things that happen. You get high carbonic smoke, the black smoke, real stiff, swirls up from it, and there's dripping naphtha. Well, neither of those. The flame kept the same shape throughout. Three, when you put it on a tank, this is on the side of the tank, just forward of the cupola on the side. If that dripping naphtha got on the tank, it would start heating it up like an oven. So the tanks that I've seen with flamethrowers, they either have it attached to or a part of the barrel of the tank, or it's mounted on the front of the tank so that it doesn't drip and heat up the tank itself. But this thing's on the side. But it wasn't until we got the footage later, thanks to Mike McNulty, of what happened a few seconds later as the tank backed out, this flame falls on the ground and bounces. Flames don't bounce. But even with that, the propagation of the original, the prima facie story that there's a flamethrowing tank took almost 10 years to almost entirely disappear from the Patriot community. It wasn't until the late 90s that the majority of the community was really on board with that there was no flamethrowing tank. However, even now, I find people that believe there was a flamethrowing tank there. So people have trouble with the middle ground. There was a tank there. It knocked down the wall. And it had a flamethrower. Well, there wasn't a flamethrower. I can't accept that because I saw the tank there. There's no middle ground. It's very difficult to find that middle ground. There was a tank there, but there was not a flamethrower. That's the middle ground. Argumentum ad hominem, everybody knows about this one. This is how the evasion of the actual topic by directing an attack on your opponent. So you can't disprove what I say, so you start calling me, it happened this morning, calling me a Fed.
Right.
So you're a Fed. You're FBI. You're CIA. You're COINTELPRO.
Provocateur.
Provocateur. Yeah, they'll throw anything at you to discredit you because they can't address your argument. And then finally is the argumentum verbosium, proof by intimidation. This is where submission of others to an argument too complex and verbose to reasonably deal with in all of its intimate detail. And where you'll see this is in a discussion where there's a subject. And then there's discussion on the subject, and both sides might present something to support theirs. And let's just say I disprove what the guy said. So he'll start taking either what he said or what I said and go off on tangents on this and make it so complex that we were dealing with one subject. Now we've got in one point of discussion, all of a sudden we've got four or five elements out there. So you go out and address one of those elements, and that evolves into four or five more to keep drawing you away from the original subject. And even though everyone can be lost, you're wasted in the loss of energy because of their verbosity of the counterattack that has nothing to do with the thing what you were talking about. So those are the things to look for when it comes to understanding where the elements of truth might exist in this. Be willing to accept that there might be shades of gray. Did the government know about Pearl Harbor and exactly when, where, and all that, which some people suggest, or the whole thing on 9/11? The government was behind it. They did this, that, and the other thing, and all that. Or is there a shade of gray on these? Was the government trying to set a scenario where the Japanese would attack the Americans? And most likely it would have been Hawaii, so that's identifiable. What day? I don't think they knew the day. There's no reason to believe that they did until that morning when radar picked up the Japanese flights, but somebody said, no, that's we've got a flight coming from California, and that's probably what it is. And they shut the radar off because they only ran the radar at night. It was new innovation, and they used visual observation in the daytime. Or September 11th. Oh, those guys weren't, those 19 or 17 people, however many it was, weren't there. That's false. They're all alive. I've seen pictures of them. Well, hell, I don't even know what they look like, but, they all look alike to me, those Middle Easterners, so I really can't say. But nobody wants to accept a shade of gray that perhaps the government knew something was going to happen. Maybe they knew where, but did they know when or anything like that? It was a very well-planned effort because the planes took off within a short period of time, and so that, with the exception of the one that went down in Pennsylvania, they were so close together that even scrambled jets from a base that was able to sustain that type of operation did not have time to arrive. But there were delays caused by the incredulity of that type of attack. And the guy that had to make a decision first to scramble the jets and finally to say, shoot down an American airliner with Americans on board. It's just unacceptable that those could have been elements of delay of being able to stop the attacks. But they were well timed. So there's a shade of gray. How much was the government knowledgeable? Did they participate in all that? Somewhere in between is the truth, but nobody wants to look at that in between. So if you look at things with an open mind and try and reason it out, maybe you can begin to see the fallacies. The unsustainable parts that are used to prop up these stories.
Well, then I guess what we're kind of looking at here is a situation where we need to present facts as facts instead of what these mythologists do, where they present their opinions as if they were facts.
Well, let's go to a recent article of mine on questionable characters, and the first subject of that was a fellow named Christopher Blystone. I have some people that work with me doing research and things like that, and so there was a whole stack of information that came in, claims of this, claims of that, and all these other things. But if you read the article, it's at outpostoffreedom.com, outpost-of-freedom.com. And then a link to questionable characters, and then a link to Christopher Blystone. When you read the initial article, there's an addendum at the bottom. But if you read the initial article, every fact is substantiated by evidence provided either within the document or linked to the document. They're facts. Nobody can argue them. Now, what happened to all the rest of this information? Well, I can't prove that he said this, or I can't prove that he said that, but I can prove that it's not true. But I can't do that because I can't prove that he said it, so that I can prove that what he said was not true. So those were omitted. All the work of all these people trying to piece this together could not find the facts to demonstrate that, say, a certain claim was made. So I can't, even though I've got the fact that disproves that claim, I can't put it in the story because it's fact-based. And in most of my writing, I try to have nothing but facts. Now, I might be suggestive of what might be implied by that, but I don't make a blatant claim that this is true because that happened. And that this goes to Beecher and Massey stories, for example. So those are facts, and you need to look for the facts. When you read something, where are the facts? And look at the facts, identify them. Good example, Thomas Jefferson made his own Bible. He went through the Bible and he cut out the portions where Jesus said, not where Peter said or James or Paul or anybody else, but what did Jesus say? He didn't want the overlay, the interpretation by the disciples. He wanted what Jesus said, and that is what's known as the Jefferson Bible. He dealt on the facts of the purported facts of what Jesus said, not the conjectures of the disciples. And so you look at things that way. Identify, get a pencil and underline or highlight on your computer those things that are provable facts. And all the other things in there might be true, might be not. Let's go back to another quote that I use on my, some quotes that I use on my signature. The conventional view serves to protect us from the painful job of thinking. So if everybody's saying Gary Hens, John Doe 4, hey, I'll just accept that. Why think about it? I heard it. That's all there is to it. I believe it. But then another one, that was from John Kenneth Galbraith. And I know people don't like him, and I know people make accusations against Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who said, it is a capital mistake to theorize before one has data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts. So if you've got a handful of facts, you can develop perhaps two or three or four or five theories that all fit the facts. But if you find have a theory that one fact disputes, then it's out the window. That theory is no good. So through a process of deduction or elimination, I can eliminate theories where the facts don't sustain that theory. So I work my way down to the possible theories, the ones that fit the facts that are known. I can't twist the facts. I can only twist the theories. And if you keep that in mind, then you can objectively look at an article and say, this doesn't meet this. Something I read this morning, I can't remember what it was, where within the article itself there was a contradiction.
And, oh, really?
Yeah. Boy, I wish I could remember what it was. I think it was this morning. I don't know. I'm getting old. But there was a definite contradiction in the story that if this happened, this couldn't have happened. If that happened, that couldn't have happened. Kind of like some of the things we've been talking about. So if you read it objectively and highlight the certain points and then go back and review them. But you have to read the whole thing, because I've noticed that people will comment on some of my articles in the discussion and they'll say, well, this isn't true. And, well, I never said it was true. And I'll refer them back. I used to answer them. I used to rewrite my article to explain it to them. And finally I said, look, why don't you read the whole article before you rush to judgments on what the article says and start criticizing me for presenting something that you put in my mouth that I didn't put in my mouth.
They didn't even finish reading it?
They didn't finish reading it. And I, you know, I have some friends that, you know, I'll talk to them about my articles and they'll, same thing happens. They didn't read the whole thing. You got to read the whole thing. Put it in context. If you don't want to read it, don't read it. If you want to read it, read the whole thing. If you read part of it, well, let's look how I structure most of my work. Introduction, body, conclusion. Introduction tells you what you're going to be reading about. Don't take that as fact. Read the article, because in the body, I will give you the facts. And the conclusion then tries to tie it up neatly in a conclusion that fits the facts. So if you read the introduction, you can make assumptions on what somebody else said about this. Let's say I start talking about UCC. We're going to talk about UCC here. And the guy doesn't believe in UCC. He'll say, well, why are you writing about UCC? You know, I know that doesn't exist. Well, shit, you didn't read the article, because I just tore UCC apart. It's not the law, but you didn't read it. So those things happen. If you don't read the whole thing and jump to conclusions, you're going to make a fool of yourself. And it's rather embarrassing sometimes. Or you can be very stoic and say, well, I know what I'm talking about. Screw you. You don't know what you're talking about. Well, I read it. I wrote it. So
There's another fallacy right there. But yeah, one aspect that's always bothered me about patriot mythology is that there's a lack of follow-up. There's really no verification of sources. So if we want to correct that, it would kind of make sense to do the complete opposite by questioning sources and reading the literature and really reading it, not skimming it like what you just described as some of those disingenuous folks who like to hurl insults or what have you, but really reading it and comprehending it. It doesn't have to be an agreement, but just comprehending it. And also, you know, something else too is that I guess another aspect as well is a need to really just challenge these alleged facts that are presented.
Well, when you go through, and now when you get used to it, you don't need to use the highlighter or a pencil to underline it or anything like that. But you got to get in the habit of looking at the facts presented and see if they're sustained. Let's go back to Joyce Riley. I read it a whole bunch of places. I just rewrote it in my words about the Act of 1871, the incorporation of Washington, D.C. Is that a fact? You know, if you're not sure, go to the source document. But what you need to do is you need to identify the erroneous facts. They're presented as facts, but if they don't fit for one reason or another, your research or are they contradictory to another fact? It was on Sunday. No, it was on Monday. That's an obvious one. But a lot of people won't catch that. How about a flame that stays the same all the time, the flame-throwing tank? When you see something like that, question it, and then now you have to resolve it. So if you want to debunk that, you've got to identify those erroneous facts and say, "Hey, that can't be true. Here's why." The flame-throwing tanks, they don't put it on the side of the tank. Or I went and read the Act of 1871, and it said it covers 10 miles square. So they've set jurisdictional boundaries like they do in any government entity. The city has city limits. The county has county boundaries. The state has state lines. Everything has jurisdictional limits, and that includes the Act of 1871. So if you read the Act and see that 10 square miles and see that they set up a governor to manage the city, they called him a governor. Later it became the mayor. The governor was appointed by Congress. The mayor, eventually, they did like other cities and let the people elect a mayor with the consent of the government, of course. But identify the erroneous facts and debunk them, challenge them. Hey, you said this, but that's not true because this says it's not true, or that can't be true because you said Monday and now you're saying Tuesday.
Right, of course. So, you know, just almost debunking, I guess, would probably be the appropriate word. And I think also, too, would be, I think this was mentioned a little bit earlier, but, you know, directing the conversation to, you know, real solutions, real things that actually, you know, like exist.
Yeah, well, we've talked about how this divides us. If somebody presents something and you're a little debunking, you've challenged certain things and removed alleged facts that can't be factual for one reason or another, I've got the facts that remain. Now that I've got these facts, do I want to just leave it as a problem or do I want to look for a solution?
Right.
If we're looking for problems, if we stack the problems, if the problems are an inch thick, and we stack all the problems that we can identify, and believe me, if you think back over your last couple of years in the Patriot community, you will make a stack that might reach to the moon by now, at least to the clouds. If they're an inch thick, it'll reach to the clouds. There are thousands of problems in this country, perhaps millions of problems in this country, perhaps tens of millions. What good are the problems? Come on, I need one more problem before I realize the government's really bad and we've got to do something about it. The solution is the solution. But if we're
Right.
spending our time looking for more problems that when we've already got a handful, you got to use a surveying experience. We were out surveying once and it was a hot day. Everybody had shorts on and Joe Williams, the party chief, was out. It was back in the chaining days before electronics. He was out at the head of the chain. He was ready to drive a stake in the ground, and he's sitting on the ground, and I was back on the instrument, and Joe started to drive the stake, and all of a sudden he started dancing. And I'm looking, oh shit, I think I know what happened. He stepped in some piss ants, got down there, and he did, and we started brushing them off of him. But when he was dancing, he was disturbing the pile, getting even more ants on him rather than getting away from the pile, the solution, and then getting the ants off. So when he brushed ants off, it just allowed more ants, more problems to crawl up his leg and start biting him. And those things are nasty, they sting. But he didn't seek a solution by getting away from it for a while. And finally, he looked for the solution. He got away from it. And then, as he brushed them off and stomped the ones that were still climbing up his that he knocked off and then brushed the rest off. He finally got out of the problem mode into the solution mode. But I'd say he spent probably close to 10 seconds jumping around, disturbing the ants, getting more of them pissed off to climb up his legs because he wasn't looking for a solution. And I don't know if that's a good analogy or not, but that's it. We keep looking for problems, and there are going to be more problems. They're going to come out of the Patriot community like the ants came out of the anthill. But we've got to look for solutions. What good are problems if we don't look for a solution? But nobody wants to look for a solution. Oh, give money to this, give money to that, vote here. All these solutions, they failed. Walking down the street with signs, even getting arrested, fail. I don't know if the government's tried to barricade a veterans memorial since back then, but the world's changed a little bit. We don't know if they're going to try and rustle some cattle again, but I think if they do, they're going to take a different approach than they did last time. Solutions force the other side to compromise or escalate.
Right, and I think kind of the unspoken yet prevalent questions, I guess, that we're kind of pointing out here is, how much bickering about grievances do these mythologies need before they choose to implement solutions? But of course, they can't afford to do that because that would require them to put up or shut up, and
Well,
they don't want to do either, do they?
not necessarily. All I have to do is learn to reject the proliferation of promises, problems. I've had enough problems. So I'm going to focus. You give me problems, man, I'm going to unfriend you. If you throw me 10 problems a day, I like you, but I'm going to unfriend you.
But then it would kind of upset the game of the role players and or those Patriots for Profits revenue stream, wouldn't it?
Sorry, my sound went off there. What were you saying?
Oh, well, can't really afford to do that too much, can they? Because it would upset the game of the role players as well as the revenue streams of the Patriots for Profit, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, there's a problem. Wait, we're looking for solutions. If we're looking for solutions, and that solution, restoration of constitutional government, will resolve all the problems all at once. Once we restore constitutional government, the problems cease to exist. All the ants are off his legs.
Yep, no more role playing and no more revenue streams for those folks. So yeah, it would kind of upset that craps game, as it were.
Yeah, and so if you're sincere as a patriot and wanting to get rid of all these problems, the problem quite simply, whether it's get rid of the Federal Reserve or anything else, the solution is to restore constitutional government, recreate the government in accordance with the Constitution because it's deviated, obviously. They think they can take the Second Amendment away. They've restricted the First Amendment. They've done so many things. But when we replace that document with that document as intended by the founders, the solution is had, and everything disappears unless you're standing in an anthill.
Right, and I think part of understanding the consequences of what this mythology does to, our people is that what it is, how do I say this? Patriot mythology really mutates the alternative media into not little else than the internet version of the mainstream media. And so if we're supposed
Oh,
to compete against mainstream media,
you mean entertainment?
yeah, that's kind of the problem, isn't it?
It
So,
is.
yes, the goal has to be, as you said, restoration of constitutional government. And the best way of doing that is through establishing local committees of safety. And quite frankly, anybody who's not talking about, at the bare minimum, about committees of safety at some point during their broadcasts, videos, articles, something, at that point, I kind of have to start questioning their sincerity, quite frankly.
Well, I'm going to refer to one more article that I've read and the other not so thin line. And it's a perspective of the Patriot community over my 30 years involvement in it. And it doesn't put it on left and right, conservative, liberal, or anything like that. It l puts it on the basis of absolute patriotism and obedience to the Constitution. That it's a line that you move from one side to the other. As you move along, you're actually progressing along the line of patriotism, becoming more and more so. And as I pointed out in another article where I gave a list of things, where were you a year ago? Where were you 2 years ago? Where do you expect to be 5 years? And then you can begin to see, think of that. Where was I as far as patriotism a year ago, 2 years ago? Maybe 5 years ago, too, if you've been in for a while. But where do I expect to be in 5 years? Now you begin to see this long, thin line, and you see that you've moved along it. But the solution is when you approach the other end of that line, the end that you're moving towards, the solution begins to come then. You're in the problem. When you enter the patriot community, you enter because of problems that you perceive. As you progress, more and more problems come into play. Somewhere along the line, though, you realize that I've got to shift towards solutions because I'm full of problems. And at that point, you start moving along more rapidly along that line because now my focus isn't on these tens of thousands of things that are thrown at me. Now I'm focusing on how can I solve all these problems? How can I get rid of all these problems at one time? And that is the pursuit of restoration of constitutional government. Now, let me throw another thought in here, too, because we're talking about truth in a lot of this. Mm-hmm. And back to the John Doe 4, it was 17 years before I decided to go public and deal with that issue. The flame-throwing tank issue took almost a decade where it shifted from probably 99% believing there was a tank to less than 50% believing there was a tank. And there's a quote from George Washington in a letter to Charles Thurston back in 1794. The quote is, "Truth will ultimately prevail where pains is taken to bring it to light." So the pursuit of the truth is synonymous with pursuit of restoration of constitutional government. And we need to know that it will ultimately prevail so long as we take the pains to bring that truth to light.
Yeah, well said. And, personally, I don't really put a lot of credence in the term of a truther because that now means, mythologist, really. But you're right. If we're talking about what actually exists objectively in reality, then sure. Because if we're going to win our freedoms back, in a sense, then we can't devolve into what the government's done, where they try to rule us with lies. We have to, as the one phrase goes, speak truth to power, and that doesn't require accuracy on our part.
Well, let me pose a question on that too, and it's one that I think we all need to consider: was the government created by the Constitution to govern the government? Or was it created by the Constitution to govern the people? The Constitution lists five crimes. There are no crimes beyond that, unless they are injuries to the government: destruction of government property, killing a government employee, violating a contract with the government. But beyond those, where you're creating damage to the government, the purpose of government is to govern the government, to deal with foreign commerce, to deal with the defense of the nation, to deal with the protection of life, liberty, and property. Those are the purposes of government. So it is not to govern us, and that is a fundamental understanding that you have to have. They have no right intruding in our lives beyond those powers and authorities granted to them, and they have to stay within the limitations imposed upon them. And that gets them back to governing the government, unless one of the five crimes, counterfeiting, treason, etc., or you damage the government, and then they, like you, have a right to go after the party that injured you. The government is to govern the government, not the people.
Right, and I think that I guess the next step in my own political education is to really learn that United States Constitution as deeply as I can, and whatever help I can get in learning it, I'd definitely appreciate it, that's for certain.
Well, I think we're going to get into the Constitution in the future, line by line. But for
I look
now,
forward to it.
I hope we've covered and closed the door on patriot mythology. If you listen to the entire series, if there's something we haven't covered, I think that you will at that point be able to perceive the inaccuracy of a lot of the mythologies. That hopefully this will be enlightening to a lot of people, and they'll be able to begin to understand how to sort out, separate the wheat from the chaff, so to speak.
Yes, and thanks for your insight on this, and it really helps clear my mind too. And so on that note, I'll say good night.
Good night, sleepy.